Percy gives me a smile, then leans forward with his elbows on his knees like he's thinking hard. Monty often smells of piss. Well, I like this one significantly less, but plays a wicked hand of whist. Better. Though Lockwood may doubt him, there's something about him that everyone just wants to... And then he stops, a bright flush creeping into his cheeks. The corners of my mouth begin to turn up. Go on, Percy. What? Finish it. Finish what? Your poem. My what? The rhyme, halfwit. Does it rhyme? I didn't realize. Oh, wait. He feigns reviewing the verse in his head. I hear it now. I lean into him. Come on now. What were you going to say? Nothing, I don't remember. Yes, you do. Go on. He makes a humming noise with his lips closed. Do you want to finish it, or do you want me to keep pestering you? Bit of a tough choice. I press my foot into his shin. His stocking has slipped from his garter and is bunched up around his ankle. But everyone just wants to what, Percy? What is it exactly that everyone wants to do to me? Fine. Now he's really blushing, poor boy. He's not so dark-skinned that he can't still go fantastically red when sufficient cause arises. He blows a short breath, then scrunches up his nose. It looks like he's working rather hard not to smile. Though Lockwood may doubt him, there's something about him that everyone just wants to kiss. That single word sends a pulse up my spine like a struck lightning rod. Percy laughs and ducks his chin, suddenly shy. I mean to sit back and say something coy so we can play it off as a laugh. I swear to God I do. But then he licks his lips and his eyes flit to my mouth in a way that seems a little out of his control. And I want to, so badly I do. Just thinking about it makes all the blood leave my head. And the drink has just enough of a hold on me that the part of my brain that usually steps in the path of terrible ideas and halts them with a sensible, steady on there lad, let's think this one through, seems to have taken the night off. So in spite of being in possession of a full understanding of what a terrible decision it is to do so, I lean in and kiss Percy on the mouth. I truly intend to make it a peck, just a small one, like it's only because of the rhyme and not because I've been going mad with wanting him for 2 years. But before I can pull away, Percy puts his hands on the back of my neck and presses me to him, and suddenly it's not me kissing Percy, it's Percy kissing me. For perhaps a full minute, I'm so stunned that the only thing I can think is, dear Lord, this is actually happening. Percy is kissing me, really kissing me. Neither of us is sober, or even sober adjacent, but at least I'm still seeing straight. And damnation, it feels so good. As good as I've always imagined it would be. It makes every other kiss I've ever had turn to smoke and disappear. And then it's not just Percy kissing me, we're kissing each other. I can't decide if I'd rather keep my hands in his hair or do something about getting his shirt out of the way. I'm feeling frantic and scrambly, unable to commit to a single place to put my hands because I want to touch him abso-bloody-lutely everywhere. Then he slips his tongue into my mouth, and I'm momentarily distracted by the way the entirety of my being spills over with that feeling. It's like being set aflame. More than that, it's like stars exploding, heavens on fire. Kissing Percy is an incendiary thing. I tug his bottom lip between my teeth and work it gently, and he lets go a bright, weighted breath as he slides from his chair onto my lap. His hands go under my shirt, tearing it out of the waistband of my breeches in handfuls. Then his arms slide all the way around me, and I'm struggling to stay soft, trying to think of the least arousing things possible, and it just isn't working because Percy's got his legs on either side of my lap, and his mouth is open against mine, and I can feel his palms up and down my back. I run my tongue down his jawline, so enthusiastic that my teeth scrape him, at the same time working my fingers against the buttons of his breeches until the essential one pops. He inhales softly with his head tipped skyward when my fingers meet his skin. His nails dig into my spine, my shirt rucked up in his fists. I know we should be careful. It's a private box, but not that private, and if anyone saw us like this, we might get in real trouble. But I don't care. not about who might be lingering nearby, or the pillory for sodomites, or my father's threat of what will happen if I'm caught with a lad. Nothing matters right then but him. Monty, he says, my name punching its way through a gasp. I don't reply because I'm far more interested in sucking on his neck than in doing any talking, but he takes my face in his hands and raises it to his. Wait, stop. I stop. It may be the hardest thing I've ever had to do, though it should be noted that I've not had a very hard life. What is it? It's ridiculous how winded I am, like I've been running. Percy looks me dead in the eyes. I've still got one hand spread like a starburst on his chest, and his heart is pounding against my fingertips. Is this just a laugh to you? No, I say before I can think it through. Then when his eyes widen a little, I pin on hastily. Yes. I don't know. What do you want me to say? I want... Nothing, forget it. Well, why'd you stop, you goose? I think we'll take up where we left off, so I lean in again, but he ducks out of the way and I freeze, my hand hovering between us. Then he says very quietly, Don't. Which is not a particularly fine thing to hear when I've still got one hand down his trousers. I don't move right away, give him a moment to change his mind and come back to me, though it's clear from his expression that I'm fooling myself in thinking he will. It's a fight to keep my face straight, pretend I don't have years' worth of wanting attached to this excellent kiss with the most gorgeous boy I know, but I manage to say, Fine, without giving away how much that single word feels like the trapdoor of a scaffold falling out from under me. Percy looks up. Really? Fine? He repeats. That's all you have to say? Fine by me. I shove him off my lap, which is what I think I would probably do if this were a laugh, but it's harder than I mean to, and he falls. You started it, you and your daft poem. Right, of course. Suddenly he sounds angry. He's fiddling with the buttons of his breeches, refastening them with more force than necessary. This is my fault. I didn't say it was your fault, Purse. I said you started it. Well, you wanted it too. Too? I wanted it too? You know what I mean. I really don't, and I really don't care. God, it was just a kiss. Right, I forgot you'll kiss anything with a mouth. Percy picks himself up with a bit of a stumble and winces. I reach out, even though I'm too far away to help. You all right? You just shoved me, and now you're asking if I'm all right. I'm trying to be decent. I think you missed that chance a long while ago. God, Purse, why are you being such a prick? Let's go home. Fine, I say. Let's go. And so we conclude what might have been a fireworks and poetry sort of evening with the most uncomfortable walk home ever shared by any two people in history. 5. I do a valiant job of ignoring Percy for the next few days. He keeps his distance as well. I can't decide if he's avoiding me or just giving me space to cool off, though not so far that I don't notice the rather telling mark on his neck that his collars aren't quite high enough to cover. It's a fine reminder of the most mortifying thing I've ever done. I don't claim a perfect record when it comes to romantic advances, but Percy's rejection stings like salt in an open wound. It plays in my head for days, over and over, no matter how hard I try to shake it off or console myself with the memory of how good it felt before it all fell apart. My attempts to scrub it out with whiskey lifted from our kitchen do no good either. I keep hearing that single word, don't, and reliving the moment he pushed me away. Lots of boys mess around at that age. I can still hear my father saying it, and it feels like a kick in the teeth every time. Lots of boys mess around, especially when it's late and they're mauled and far from home. I stay comfortably drunk for the next few days, perhaps towing the line between comfortably and deliriously, for I forget entirely that my father arranged for us to accompany Lord Ambassador Worthington to Versailles for a summer ball, until Lockwood announces it over breakfast in a voice that implies I'm an imbecile for forgetting. But it is, however temporary, a distraction from thinking of Percy. And Lockwood won't be coming, so it might be a properly good evening. Felicity seems to be laboring under the delusion that she will not be required to attend, in spite of the fact that she shopped for outfitting alongside Percy and me when we first arrived. She gives an unconvincing performance of nondescript unwellness, and seems shocked when Lockwood is unmoved. When she finally agrees to dress, she emerges from her room looking as though she's put the least effort possible into it. She's in the French gown tailored for her, which was rather matronly to begin with, but no cosmetics, and her hair is in the same twisted plait she's worn it in all day. She hasn't even washed the ink off her fingers, the remnants of some scribblings she's been doing in the margins of her novel. Her maid follows, looking cowed. Lockwood gives a dramatic sucking in of the cheeks, paired with an equally dramatic tapping of the foot as he surveys her. Felicity folds her arms and surveys him straight back. She's a fierce, stubborn creature when she wants to be, and, I begrudgingly allow, it can be glorious.
"It seems," Lockwood says at last, "that the three of you all lack an understanding of the reality of your positions."
"The reality is I don't see the point in me being made to attend tonight," Felicity says. "I've asked to go see the galleries with you and Monty and Percy, and hear the lectures, but you..."
"Well, for a start, I must say I find it inappropriate how informal you are with each other," Lockwood interrupts. "From now on, I'd like to hear you address one another properly. No given names, please, or these pet names of which you seem fond."
I nearly burst out laughing at that. I can't imagine calling Percy Mr. Newton with a straight face, nor can I see Felicity doing the same. Percy's around so often they might as well be siblings. They certainly get on better than she and I do. Though I'm rather cheered by the thought of Felicity being made to address me as my lord. Lockwood catches my grin before I can pocket it, and pivots his sights.
"And you! Such blatant disregard for one's own privilege, I have never witnessed. Do you know what I was doing when I was your age? I joined the navy, risking my life for king and country. I did not have the chance or the means to take a tour of the continent, and here you are handed that opportunity at no personal sacrifice, and you squander it."
Well, this situation certainly got away from me. I don't see why it's me getting the lecture when it's only Felicity being belligerent.
"And,"
Lockwood turns to Percy, seems to decide there's nothing about him that's really worth getting worked up over, and moves back to a collective address.
"Be forewarned that I will have very little patience for further antics from any of you. Am I understood?"
"We are late," is all Felicity says in reply, which we are. Lockwood is immediately flustered, calling for our footman and ushering us to the door, our departure so hasty that Felicity isn't made to clean up, which is unfair. "You'll be the talk of the evening in that rig," I say to her as I offer her my hand into the carriage. "Tell me, is that actual sackcloth or simply plain muslin?" "Well, you've enough frills for the both of us," she replies, ignoring my hand. "You'll put the ladies to shame." I resist the urge to rip some of the ruched trim off the mint-coloured coat I had until this moment thought was quite handsome. My little sister has inherited from my father the knack for making me a self-conscious fool about everything. "I think you look nice," Percy tells me, which makes me want to throw something at him. He's got on an indigo coat with a flowered brocade along the cuffs and velvet breeches to match. It isn't fair that we are quarrelling and he still looks so goddamn fantastic. We meet the Lord Ambassador and his wife at the palace gates. He's a tall fellow with a grey buckle-rolled wig, and he has a sword hanging from his belt. His wife is short and stout, though her hair makes her nearly as tall as he is. She's powdered pale as milk, a distinct rim at her hairline that the cone missed, with too much rouge over top and a pox patch beneath each eye. In their poor imitation of French fashion, they look like pastries in a bakery window at the end of the day, trying a bit too hard to be beautiful as they wilt.
"Lord Disley?"
The Lord Ambassador gives me a firm handshake when we meet, with one hand on my elbow like he's trying to buckle me to his side. It's a bit of an effort to pry my way out.
"Well met, my lord. Very well met. I've heard so much about you from your father."
Which starts the evening off on a remarkably sour note. The Lord Ambassador ignores Percy when he gives his hand, instead offering up a critical and not at all subtle up and down before he turns to Felicity.
"And Miss Montague, you look so very much like your mother. Such a lovely woman. You'll be so lovely some day.
Felicity frowns like she's trying to work out whether or not what he said was a jab. I'm not certain either, though that frown is doing nothing for the case of her current loveliness.
Oh, stop that, Robert. She's already gorgeous,
his wife says, which seems to make Felicity even more uncomfortable.
Lady Worthington takes her by the arm and makes her spin once, which Felicity executes with halting steps, like she isn't entirely certain what is happening, but is quite certain she doesn't like it.
What an interesting dress,
the Lord Ambassador's wife remarks, and I can't resist a snort at that one. Worthington frowns at me, so does Percy, which is far more annoying.
As one lady coos and the other reluctantly allows herself to be cooed at, the Lord Ambassador takes me aside and says in a confidential whisper,
"You're... who is that, precisely?"
He nods to Percy, who is doing a rather obvious pantomime of not eavesdropping.
"My friend," I reply flatly. "He's my friend."
"Does your father know?
He didn't mention you'd be bringing..." "Percy's travelling with me," I say. "We're touring together."
Oh, of course. Mr. Newton."
The note of surprise in his voice is as blatant as a battle axe as he turns to Percy.
"I know your uncle."
"Do you?" Percy asks.
"Yes, old friends. He had just been appointed to the Admiralty Court when I was still a merchant out of Liverpool. He never mentioned he had a ward that was..."
He drifts off, pumping his hand in a circle like he might waft an appropriate ending to that sentence our way, then instead says,
"You've been in Paris since May, have you? How do you find it?"
When I don't answer, Percy steps in.
"Very interesting. Such a fine, fine city, Paris. Though we find the food to be rather less to our taste. The food is better in London."
"But the beds are better in Paris," I say.
"Shall we go in?" Percy says quickly.
The Lord Ambassador's eyes narrow a bit at me. Then he claps my shoulder before leading us up the drive.
I jog to catch him up before Percy can fall into step beside me.
Versailles is a delirious fantasy of a place. We cross through a card room and into the mirrored hall where the king receives his court, every surface not covered with a looking glass, gilded in gold or frescoed in jewel tones. Wax drips in hot, sticky threads from the chandeliers. The light is pyrite, with snowflakes of colour refracted through the crystals splattering the walls. The party spills into the gardens, the air hot and hazy with pollen rising from the flowers in golden bursts when they're brushed. Hedges line the walks, carved into a menagerie of shapes, roses bursting between them. The stars are stifled by the furious light from the palace, and the candelabra lining the stairs are reflected like glittering coins against the bright silk everyone is wearing. People mill along the paths, and beneath the open dome at the center of the orangerie, foamy blossoms and soft-tongued orchids pressing their leaves against the glass, like hands. The women are stuffed into skirts supported by panniers that make them as wide as they are tall, and everyone's hair is powdered and curled and pasted into sculptural rigidity. Percy and I are two of the only men who aren't wigged. My hair grows so thick and dark and ruffles so handsomely that I refuse to cover it until it ceases to be all or any of those things. No one takes notice of our announcement. The atmosphere is already far too feverish. The ambassador's wife peels Felicity away from us, leaving Percy and me to her husband. I try to wander away to secure both a drink and someone to make eyes at across the crowd that I can promise will end with someone's trousers off, but Worthington sticks closer to me than I would like, making introductions to a parade of nobles who all look the same in their wigs and powder, and forcing me to be a spectator to polite conversation about the poet Voltaire's exile to England, whether bachelors should be made to pay higher taxes, the broken-off engagement between the boy king of France and the Spanish Infanta, and what that means for relations between the houses of Habsburg and Bourbon.
"This is going to be the rest of your life," says a small voice in the back of my head. I've never been good at feigning sincerity or pretending to be keen on things I'm not, and I haven't a clue what to say to these people. I'm accustomed to spending parties like this either mucking about with Percy or drinking until I found someone else to muck about with. But Percy's being annoying, and the Lord Ambassador has a nasty habit of waving servers with the wine and champagne away. I finally manage to get my hand around a glass, but when I try to have it refilled, he puts his hand over the top, never breaking eye contact with the lady he's speaking to. I survive the rest of the conversation by imagining taking my empty coupe and shoving it either down his throat or up his arse. "I hear you have a bit of a problem," he says to me as the other half of his conversation wafts away. "Excess is not flattering, young man." I'd take sloppy drunk over dull and restrained any day, though saying that aloud doesn't seem likely to aid in the refilling of my glass. Percy stays with us, though a bit apart. His desire to keep post-kiss distance from me seems to be doing battle with his desire to not be alone in this crowd. If I'm riding on the coattails of my father's connections in being here, he's clinging to the seams, with no title, a gentry family, and the darkest skin of anyone who isn't minding the refreshments. Most people we meet either gape openly like he's fine art on display, or pretend he doesn't exist. One woman actually claps her hands in delight when she spots him, like she's just witnessed a soft-eared puppy perform a trick. "You know, I'm very involved in your cause," she keeps saying to him as her husband natters on to Worthington and me, until Percy finally asks, "What cause?" She looks shocked he had to ask. "The abolition of the slave trade, of course. My club has been boycotting slave-grown sugarcane since the winter." "That's not really my cause," Percy replies.
"Where are you headed next?"
her husband asks, and it's a moment before I realize he's addressing me. I'm caught between wanting to smack the pox patches off this woman's face and to smack Percy because I'm still angry about our kiss. Perhaps I could get them both with a wide swing.
"Marseille at the end of summer, didn't you say, Disley?"
Worthington prompts. "Yes," I reply. "Then east to Venice, Florence and Rome, perhaps Geneva."
"How long since you came from Africa?"
the woman asks. And Percy replies, his tone remarkably gentle for what a jilt she's being. "I was raised in England, madam."
"You should speak to my club before you leave Paris,"
she says, bobbing toward him like a top about to tip.
"I don't think..."
"We were in Venice earlier this year,"
her husband says, dragging me back into his conversation.
"Quite a place. You should see San Bartolomeo's while you're there. The frescoes are better than at St. Mark's, and the friars will walk you up to the bell tower if you're willing to part with some coinage. Avoid the carnival. It's all hedonism and masquerades."
"Oh, and there's an island off the coast with a chapel. Can't remember the name, but it's been sinking into the lagoon. It'll be underwater by the end of summer." "My club meets Thursday evenings,"
the woman is saying, and Percy is replying, "I don't think I'd have anything to say." But she pushes on.
"To have been raised the way you were, in a wealthy household with natural children."
I can feel waves of second-hand embarrassment wafting off Percy, like I'm standing too close to an oven, and the gentleman is tapping the bowl of his clay pipe against the back of his hand, out of time with the music. And I want a drink so badly, I can hardly think straight.
"It's a dramatic sight, crumbling and half sunk into the sea."
His pipe knocks into his ring with a clatter that sets my teeth on edge.
"We took a boat out, though they only let you get so close."
"Well, doesn't that just sound like the most fun thing I can imagine?" I interrupt, louder than I mean to, though I don't retreat from it.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Sitting in a boat and watching an island sink slowly into the sea," I say. "What a thrill. Perhaps, while we're 1,000 miles from home, we'll also take in an eyeful of tea boiling." The gentleman is so shocked he takes an actual step backward from me, which is a tad dramatic.
"Merely a suggestion, my lord. I thought you might enjoy..."
"I can't imagine I would," I reply, stone-faced.
"Well then, I'm sorry to have wasted your time. Excuse us."
He takes his wife's arm, and as he leads her away, I hear her say,
"Negroes are so standoffish."
A fitting end to a conversation that was essentially prolonged mortification for all parties involved. The ambassador looks as though he's about to scold me, but he's distracted when his wig catches on a passing woman's, and they're both nearly uncoiffed. I look over at Percy, hoping he might thank me for saving him from conversing further with that cow, and then we'll conspire about how bloody awful this night has turned out to be. but he's frowning at me with nearly the same enthusiasm as the ambassador. "What's wrong with you?" I ask. He blows a sharp sigh through his nose. "Must you be an ass to everyone you meet?"
He was the one giving daft travel advice.
You're being obnoxious. Soon's purse. Be a bit gentle, why don't you? Can't you put in some effort? Please. Even if you don't give a whit what anyone has to say, these are important people. People who could be good for you to know, and even if they weren't, you should at least try to be kind. God, I would cut off my own feet for my champagne glass to magically refill itself in this moment. I'm craning my neck for a passing server. I really don't care who anyone here is. Percy grabs me by the sleeve, pulling me around so we're face to face. The back of his hand brushes mine and we shy from each other like spooked horses. That goddamn kiss is ruining my life.
Well, you should.
Why does it matter to you? I snap, shoving my fists into my pockets. His cravat has slipped, and I can see my teeth marks crawling up his neck, which is just bloody aggravating.
Because we can't all have the luxury of not caring what people think of us.
I scowl. Leave me alone. Go speak to someone else.
Who am I meant to speak to?
Fine, go serve the drinks then, I snap, and immediately wish I hadn't. I reach out before he can say anything and take hold of his arm. Wait, I'm sorry. He shrugs off my grip.
Thanks for that, Monty.
I didn't mean...
But you did, he said, then stalks away. All the righteous indignation I've been nursing for days wilts like butter in the sun.
Worthington reappears suddenly at my side, scraping a hand along his wig. A small blossom of starchy powder blooms from its strands.
Where's Mr. Newton gone?
Don't know, I reply, resisting the urge to toss back my coop one more time to make certain there isn't a last swallow clinging to the bottom.
Come here. You should be introduced to the Duke of Bourbon, he says,
fastening my arm in a surprisingly strong grip, and I am pivoted to face a man coming toward us. He's a stocky and ungenial-looking fellow in a red and gold justaucorps with a curled wig enveloping his head like a horned cyclone.
Do try and be civil. This is the young king's former prime minister. He's just been dismissed for unknown reasons. Still a touchy subject.
I really don't care, I reply, though in the back of my head I can hear Percy's admonition to try and be kinder like the echo of a cymbal. A stab of guilt goes through me, and I think, perhaps, it might be novel to give this society manners thing a bit of an effort.
Good evening, my lord.
The ambassador darts into the path of the Duke, who looked ready to pass us by, and offers a short bow.
Bonsoir, ambassadeur, the Duke replies, hardly bothering to make eye contact. You look well.
Always a pleasure. A fine evening, as is usually had here.
How good to see you. Not that it's a surprise. Of course you're here. Bourbon looks as though he'd like to sidle away from this conversation, though the ambassador seems equally as desperate to keep him anchored.
Will His Majesty be in attendance?
His Majesty remains indisposed, the Duke replies.
A shame. We all pray for his swift recovery, as always. May I present Lord Henry Montague, Viscount of Disley, recently arrived from England.
Just try, says Percy's voice in my head.
I give the Duke the most sincere smile I can muster, dimples employed for fullest effect, and offer him the same small bow the ambassador did.
It feels like a strange imitation, a stage version of the way I've seen other men behave.
It's a pleasure.
The pleasure is mine, he says, his tone noticeably absent of any pleasure, as he wraps me in a stare that could pin a man to the wall. You're Henri Montague's eldest.
Always a hideous place to start, but I keep that luminous smile fixed.
Yes. Henry is touring, the ambassador says.
Like that might somehow open a conversational door, but the Duke ignores him and keeps that calculating gaze fixed upon me. It raises the hairs on the back of my neck. He's not a tall fellow, but he's solid, and I'm neither of those things. In that steel-tipped stare of his, I feel significantly smaller than usual.
How fares your father of late? He asks. Ah, yes,
the ambassador gives a fluttery laugh. He's fiddling with his sleeve links.
Your father is French, isn't he, Disley? I'd forgotten. Are the two of you close?
The Duke asks. I can feel fat drops of sweat,
sticky with my hair pomade rolling down the back of my neck. I wouldn't say close.
Do you see much of him?
Well, not lately, as we've the English Channel between us. I give myself a bit of a hat tip for that, clever but not impertinent. I might not be as terrible at this as I thought. The Duke doesn't smile.
Are you mocking me?
Worthington makes a sound that's rather like choking.
No, I say quickly. No, not at all. It was a jest. At my expense.
It was the way you said it.
Is there something wrong with the way I speak?
No, I look between them. The ambassador is staring at me with his jaw unhinged.
Would you like me to explain it?
The Duke's frown goes deeper.
Do you think I'm an imbecile?
Dear God, what is happening? This conversation is suddenly a wriggling fish between my fingers, and I'm losing my grip.
I think we've misstepped somewhere,
I say, offering my best apologetic smile.
You were asking about my father.
The Duke doesn't return it.
I'm afraid I've lost the thread.
I slump a few inches nearer to the ground.
Sorry. Your father has a pointed sense of humor. Clearly you take after him.
Do I? I look between him and the ambassador again, though neither seems willing to come to my rescue.
What do you mean, pointed sense of humor?
Would you like me to explain it?
The Duke replies, a bitter mimic. The best strategy seems to be fleeing back to the summit of this tangential peak and pretending we never scaled it. So I say, I was seeing a great deal of my father before I left for the continent. My mother's just had a child, and that's kept him at home.
Ah.
The Duke fishes a silver vinaigrette from his pocket and takes a grand sniff.
The last I heard, he was staying more at his estate to keep an eye upon a delinquent son who enjoyed drinking and boys more than he did his studies at Eton.
All the colour drains out of my face. A few people glance our way, key phrases in his statement catching gossip-hungry ears. The Duke gives me a cool expression, and I'm quite ready to either overturn a table or do a dramatic collapse to the ground. Perhaps both, in quick succession.
Look, see, I would shout at Percy, if he were here beside me. This is what happens when I try.
Ambassador Worthington makes a verbal hurdle between us.
This is Henri Montague's son,
he offers, as though there's been some kind of mistake.
Yes, I know, the Duke replies.
Then back to me, he says, and by all reports I've heard, he's a scoundrel.
Well, at least I've not been dismissed from my position as lapdog to an invalid puppet of a king, I snap.
The Duke's smugness slips like a poorly laced mask. For the first time since the start of our egregious interaction, he seems to be considering something other than making me look a fool, though this thing seems to be whether it would be appropriate to strangle me with his bare hands in the middle of mixed company.
Watch that tongue, Montague, he says, his voice low and coiled, a poisonous snake lurking in the tall grass.
And he snaps his vinaigrette shut and stalks away, leaving the ambassador and me both staring after him like wax figures of ourselves. My ears are still ringing. I'm unsure whether my father is going out of his way to speak badly of me to all his intimates and make a real meal of my humiliation, or whether I've such a foul reputation that the stench has preceded me here. And what's worse, I'm not sure which of those options is preferable. Worthington's face is still stuck in its mask of polite society when he turns to me, but the steam coming out of his ears is nearly palpable. I expect a stuttered second-hand apology, some sort of gasping and fawning, and poor Monty, I'm so terribly sorry he said such hateful things to you. Instead, he says to me, very calmly,
"How dare you speak to him like that?"
Which is when I realize he isn't on my side either.
"Did you hear what he said to me?"
I demand.
"He is your better."
"I don't care if he's the bleeding king. He insulted..." Worthington reaches suddenly for me, and my hands fly up, an involuntary defense. But all he does is place his palm upon my arm in an almost pitying way and say,
"When your father wrote to request I make your introductions, I had it in my head he was exaggerating about your lack of moral fortitude. But I see he's been rather astute in his assessment. Now, I believe your father to be a first-rate fellow, so I place no responsibility upon him. He's no doubt done the best he could, yet sometimes the tares fall among the wheat. But this devil-may-care attitude you believe so charming, tossing your social connections into the fire and instead choosing to associate with colored men such as your Mr. Newton. Let's get something straight, I interrupt, jerking my arm out of his grip with such force that I nearly knock out the woman standing behind me. You are not my father. I am not your responsibility, and I did not come here to have a list of my faults related from him or be condemned for who I associate with, not by you or that damned Duke. So while it's been a jolly good time being treated like a child all evening, I think I've just about had enough, and I can make my own way from here. And then I turn on my heel and march off, snatching a glass from the tray of a passing server as I go, draining it, and replacing it before he's even noticed me. If my father is so keen on telling everyone what a rake I am, I'm happy to live up to my reputation. Wouldn't want to disappoint him. It's an impressive performance as far as dramatic storm-offs go, but as soon as I've left Worthington, I realize I've got nowhere to storm off to. I look around for Percy. I'm ready to surrender our standoff just for the sake of company, and perhaps a bit of sympathy as well. I spot him over near the dance floor and start to weave through the crowd, but then I realize he's talking to someone. A lad in a blonde wig, who looks a bit older than us, with such stark freckles I can see them under his powder. He's got on a fine suit of ribbed grey silk with ruffles at the collar that swing when he leans in to Percy so that whatever he's saying can be heard over the music. Percy says something in return, and the lad laughs, open-mouthed, with his head thrown back. Percy gives him a shy smile, and the freckled little shit touches him on the arm and then leaves his damn hand there for far longer than is really necessary. I've never wanted so badly to knock someone's teeth in as I do right then. Knock those stupid freckles straight off his face. The freckled buck flags one of the servers for champagne, one for him and Percy each, and I whip around and go in the opposite direction. Felicity is on the veranda, valiantly holding up a wall between two Venetian windows, and I swallow my pride and join her, snagging another coop along the way. You're looking jaded, I say, as I lean into the stone. And you're looking angry. Are you and Percy still quarrelling? Is it that obvious? Well, considering that you're barely looking at each other, it seemed logical. Where's the ambassador got to? Don't know. I'm hiding from him. And I'm hiding from his wife. Cheers to being no good at parties. I'm usually very good at parties. I think it's the party's fault. A knot of people pushes past us, the woman in the lead carrying a wine glass in one hand and a chocolate entremet aloft in the other. The train of her dress scrapes over our feet as she passes, and Felicity and I both press closer to the wall. "Who are you and he speaking to?" she asks. "The solid fellow." "The Duke of Bourbon, I think his title is. He's the charm of an aging Genghis Khan." To my great surprise, Felicity gives a rather genuine snort of laughter. It catches us both off guard, her hand flies to her mouth, and we go wide-eyed at each other. Then she shakes her head with a rueful chuckle. "Aging Genghis Khan, you do make me laugh sometimes." I swallow a mouthful of champagne. The bubbles are making my tongue feel like woven cloth. "Former Prime Minister to the King, though apparently that former part is still touchy, so don't go bringing it up. Learn that the hard way. Is the King here? Isn't this his party?" "He's ill, nearly perpetually from the sound of it." It strikes me suddenly how very backward it feels to be skirting the edges of a party with my sister, while Percy is somewhere on the other side. I take another drink, then ask just for something to say. "So where were you sneaking off to the other night?" Felicity tips her head back to the wall, so she's staring up at the scrollwork overhanging us. "Nowhere?" "You were meeting a boy, weren't you?" "When would I have had time to meet a boy? I've hardly been allowed to leave the apartment since we arrived. Lockwood makes me sit still and stitch and play the harpsichord all day and night while you and Percy are traipsing around the city." "Oh, traipse is hardly the word I'd use. Shuffle like prisoners, perhaps?" "Well, you're seeing far more of Paris than I've been permitted to." "So is that where you were, seeing the sights in the dead of night?" "If you must know, I was at that lecture."
"What lecture?"
"The alchemical one, the one you told Lockwood you attended."
"Oh."
I'd forgotten everything that happened that night except the kiss. I almost look around for Percy again.
"Are you interested in alchemy?"
"Not particularly. I'm disinclined to superstition on the whole,
But the idea of creating synthetic panaceas from existing organic substances by altering their resting chemical state... I'm sorry, am I boring you? No, I stopped listening a while ago. I mean for it to be glib and silly, something that might make her laugh again. But instead a look of rather sincere hurt flits across her face before she covers it with a frown. I'm about to apologize, but then she snaps. If you aren't interested, don't ask. My own temper, still raw from Worthington's telling off, flares again. Fine. In future I'll refrain. I raise my glass, which is somehow empty. Have a good time here by yourself. Enjoy avoiding the ambassador, she replies, and I wander off before I can decide whether she was being mean. As much as I like crowds and champagne and dancing, I feel like I'm starting to sink into this party and be swallowed by it. A strange panic spawned from all the filigree is sitting right at the edge of my mind. It's the sort of feeling I would usually combat by sneaking away with Percy and a bottle of gin, but Percy is off somewhere having his arm touched by that lad whose freckles look like a pox, so instead I wander along the veranda, losing tally of how much I've had to drink. I stop and rest my elbows upon the rail, surrounded on all sides by rustling satin and a language I can hardly speak, and feeling very, very alone. Then, from beside me, someone says, "You look lost." I turn. A startlingly pretty young woman is standing behind me, her wide skirt fanned between us like the pages of a book. She has large, dark eyes with a patch in one corner, and skin powdered almost white but for the poppy of rouge upon each cheek. Her stiff blonde wig is arranged around sprigs of juniper and an ornament in the likeness of a fox, its ear tipped in the same inky black that lines her lashes. She's got the most incredible neck I've ever seen, and directly below it, a truly fantastic set of breasts. "Not at all," I reply, ruffling my hair on instinct. "Simply making a careful choice of the best company. Though I think the search is ended now that you're here." She laughs, a tiny pretty sound like a bell that doesn't strike me as entirely genuine, but I'm quite certain I don't care. "I come highly recommended. Are you on your tour?" And here I thought I was blending in rather well. "Your scholarly study of the party sets you apart, my lord. Your thinking face is very handsome." And then she touches my arm lightly, same as that lad put his hand on Percy. I fight a sudden urge to look around for him in the crowd, and instead shift my weight along the rail so the entirety of my attention is devoted to this lovely creature, who seems very interested in me. "Have you a name, my foxy lady?" I ask. "Have you?" she counters. "Henry Montague." "How simple," she says, and I realize my error in omitting my title. I'm a bit drunker than I thought if I'm making such careless mistakes. "Your father must be French." "Oui, though you wouldn't know it from how ghastly my French is." "Should we make things easier?" she says in English, words silk-trimmed by her accent. "Now we'll understand each other better. So, shall I call you Henry? If we are foregoing formality, you may call me Jeanne." She tips down her chin and gives me a look through the veil of her eyelashes. "Oh dear," it says, "now I'm shy." "Acceptable?" "Divine." She smiles, then flicks open the ivory fan hanging from her wrist and begins to work it up and down. The breeze flutters the single ringlet trailing down the back of that neck of hers that swans would envy. I have been mentally patting myself on the head for keeping my eyes on her face the whole time we've been speaking, but then the bastards betray me suddenly and dive straight down the front of her dress. I think for a moment she may not have noticed, but then her mouth twists up, and I know she's seen. But instead of slapping me or calling me a boor and storming off, she says, "My lord, would you like to see..." Telling pause, eyelash flutter. "More of Versailles?" You know, I believe that I would, though I'm short a guide. "Perhaps you'll allow me? But this party seemed to be just picking up speed. I'd hate to drag you away." "Life is filled with sacrifices." "Am I a sacrifice?" "One I am happy to make." Zounds, this girl is fun. And right now, I need a bit of fun.
get my mind off Worthington and the damned Duke and Percy and that handsome bastard with the freckles putting his hands all over him. I offer her my arm. Lead the way, my lady. Jeanne puts her small, perfect hand on my elbow and steers me toward a set of French doors opening into the hall. As we cross the threshold, I let slip my resolution for a single second and, like Lot's wife, turn to Salt, glance over my shoulder to see if I can spot Percy. He's right where he was before, on the fringes of the dance floor, but alone now and looking at me in a way that suggests he's been doing it for a while. When I catch his eye, he starts and gives a self-conscious tug on his jacket collar. Then he offers me a bit of a disappointed smile, and I'd expect no more from you sort that strikes flint inside me. My mind plays a quick roulette of what variety of look in return will most affect him. Perhaps pleading eyes save me from this girl dragging me away against my will, and then he'll come rushing to my rescue. Or perhaps a curled-lipped sneer. Jealous? Well, you had your chance with me, and you missed it. I settle on a shrug paired with an indifferent smirk. That's fine, it says. You have your fun, and I'll have mine. And perhaps a smidge of, I'm not even a bit thinking of what transpired between us at the music hall last week. And Percy looks away. Jeanne knows her way through the gilded labyrinth that is the interior of Versailles, and she drifts along like a cloud of perfume. Every room we wander through is filled with people, and though I enjoy the crowds and the noise and the frescoes, the colours of a bowl of ripe fruit, I would much rather find a quiet place to be alone with this winsome girl and her excellent breasts. She leads me to a deserted wing I'm certain we aren't meant to be in, then stops before a painted door and slides her hand into the pocket slit of her skirt, withdrawing a gold key on a black ribbon. "Now, where did you get that?" I ask, leaning in as she unlocks the door like I'm interested in it. But really, it's to get a better angle down that dress. She smiles. "My position comes with privileges." The room she leads me into looks like a private parlor, the antechamber to someone's bedroom. 3 crystal chandeliers cast a golden glow across the rich red walls and mahogany furnishings. There's a fireplace so large that it seems rather a small room that can be safely set on fire, and an oriental rug so thick it makes me feel wobbly in my heels. The window is open onto the grounds, and the music and bright chatter of the party waft in, though they sound muted and far away. Jeanne slips her fan from her wrist, then spreads her hands across the felt-topped card table before the fireplace. "This is quieter, no? Versailles can be overwhelming." "Oh, I find it rather whelming." She laughs, and I give her what I know from experience is a knee-weakening smile. "Quite a scandal to bring a gentleman unaccompanied to your apartments, madam." "How fortunate that these aren't my apartments, though you flatter me in thinking I've rooms this grand." "A friend of mine," she says, enough of a lilt on friend that I can make the inference. "Louis Henri."
"Louis the King?"
"There is more than one Louis in all of France, you know. This one's the Duke of Bourbon."
"Oh, him."
"You sound as though you've met."
"Yes, we had words." I don't mention the particulars of the incident, though the thought of it makes me feel small and shriveled up again. But now here I am in his apartments. Retaliation is calling my name. My first idea is to piss in his desk drawers, but there's a lady present. Thievery seems a better choice, something easy enough to get away with, but not so obvious as to tie me to the crime. The task is to pick something that will annoy the shit out of him when he finds it missing, but not incite an international incident. I wander around the salon, making a show of inventorying the place, a casual thief. I can feel Jeanne watching me, so I keep my chin tipped up, waiting for her to look away so that I can pocket something. Though I'm rather hard to look away from, I'm giving her my finest angle, the sort that belongs on a coin. Atop the desk there's a set of ivory dice that I consider, and a scent and patch case with a clear glass facet and silver screw top. Fine movables, everything here is fine, but too ordinary to achieve the desired level of annoyance. At the writing desk I flirt briefly with the notion of nicking the inkstand until I realize it would be beastly inconvenient to carry around for the rest of the night as it's full of ink. But beside the inkstand there's a small trinket box made of slick ebony,
and a little larger than my fist. The top is set with 6 opal dials, each inscribed with the alphabet in sequence. When I run my finger along them, they turn, the letters shifting.
All right, you've seen the room,
Jeanne calls. There's a rustle of skirts as she settles herself.
Come pay attention to me now.
I glance up to see if she's watching, but she's already seated at the card table with her back to me. Vengeance and a pretty girl, the pair is turning this initially disastrous evening into one of the better parties we've been to in Paris. If only Percy and I weren't quarrelling, I think, then squash that thought like a spider underfoot. I slip the box into my pocket. Consider leaving a ransom note as well, or not so much a ransom note as a 3-word statement, you're a bastard. Then slide into the chair across the table from Jeanne.
Are we playing?
I ask as she flicks a deck of cards between her hands. Her eyes dart to mine. What do you play?
Everything. Anything.
What do you play, madam?
Well, I find myself partial to a game in which each player is dealt 2 cards, adds their numbers, and whichever pair is a sum closer to 10 and 3, wins.
Why 10 and 3?
It's my lucky number.
I've not heard of this game.
That is because, my good lord, I have just now made it up.
And is there to be a wager? Or a consequence for the player with cards less close?
They must sacrifice an article of clothing.
Good lord. I deserve some sort of medal for the effort it takes not to look down her dress when she says that. Jeanne purses her lips, smearing the scarlet paint upon them.
Do you care to play?
Deal me in. I whip off my coat and toss it onto the sofa.
Hold on, we've not started yet.
I know. I don't want to make it too hard for you. I hate for you to lose your dignity.
Don't count on that, my lord.
It is an incredibly stupid game. We both know it. We also both know that the true game is not in the cards, but in the coquettish removal of each subsequent article of clothing. Jeanne slides off one of her many rings. I remove my shoes in what can only be described as the most sensual display any man has ever made with his footwear. I'm more liberal with the undressing. By the time I'm in nothing but my breeches, she's still peeling off jewelry one excruciating piece at a time. Under her powder, her cheeks are pink, but she's keeping her wits about her admirably. Were our situations reversed, I would have lost my mind by now. The lead-up is fun, but I'm starting to grow restless to be done with this, like downing a sour drink fast, which is not the sentiment I'm accustomed to accompanying earthly delights of this variety. Out on the veranda, a bit of a romp seemed like an unbearably magnificent idea. But as I wait for Jeanne to make a theatrical show of flipping her next pair of cards, my mind is stuck on the image of Percy and that lad standing beside the dance floor, and wondering what it was that Percy said that made him laugh. And then I'm thinking about Percy's fingers threading through my hair as I leaned into him, and him pressing our mouths together. The flutter of his breath passed between us, a feeling like a pulse point, and I'll be damned if one stupid kiss with Percy has ruined me. The next time Jeanne loses, she removes a single pearl-drop earring and sets it on the table, but I place my hand over hers before she can deal again. One moment, my lady. Earrings come in pairs.
So?
So they come off in pairs, too. No protesting, I took my shoes off together.
I'm beginning to think it doesn't take much to get your clothes off.
Well, I don't want to deprive you.
Thank you, my lord. You are indeed a fine specimen.
She touches her top lip with the tip of her tongue, and a soft shiver of desire goes through me, chased with relief that Percy has not wrecked me after all. Perhaps this can still be exactly what I intended when I followed her from the gardens, and it is with that hope buoyant in my heart that I lean toward her. Here, let me help you with that other earring. I reach out. She leans in. Time turns slow and delicious, seconds rolling forward like sun-warmed honey. I put my mouth much closer to her skin than it needs to be as I unclasp the pearl. My fingers trail down her neck, the ghost of a touch. Then I waft my lips across her jawline. And, as I knew would come to pass, she puts a finger beneath my chin, tips my mouth toward hers, and kisses me. But my first thought is not how absolutely gorgeous it is to have this pretty thing at last putting her lips upon mine. It is how much better it was the week previous when it was Percy doing the same. I nearly swat the air like that might clear Percy from my head as though he were a gnat. Instead, I put my hands on those two magnificent breasts that have been staring me down the whole evening and distract myself with the business of freeing them from their casings, and I'm not thinking about Percy, not even a bit. Aristocratic ladies, it should be noted, wear a beastly lot of clothing, particularly at parties. I could strip to nothing in 20 seconds if given adequate motivation, and she's more than adequate. But undressing Jeanne is not as easy as it was when I imagined it every time she removed another piece of jewellery. My mouth is still on hers as we stagger to our feet, so I haven't even got a good view of what it is I meant to be ripping off. I take a guess and tear at the laces until something snaps and the stomacher falls away, which at least pops her breasts from their breast prison. But then there's a ghastly cage around her waist, with petticoats and corsets and a chemise, and I swear to God there's another corset under that, and then a whole creative other layer of who knows what, but I'm certain it's there simply to keep me from her skin. Perhaps fashion is just a reinforcement of a lady's chastity, in hopes that the interested party may lose interest and abandon any deflowering attempts simply for all the clothing in the way. In contrast, Jeanne only needs undo 4 buttons on the flap of my breeches and then slide them down my hips, which is just unfair. Her fingers wend their way up my spine, and I'm shocked suddenly from the moment by the memory of Percy's hands there, his palms, parentheses, around my ribcage, and a touch that made me feel hungry and breakable. His legs wrapped around me, the sound of his short, sharp breath when I put my lips to his neck. God damn it, Percy! I let go of Jeanne just long enough to unfasten the buttons at my knees and get my breeches around my ankles. Then I kick them onto the sofa in a high arc. She traces my lips with the tip of her tongue, talc from her skin coating my mouth, and, hellfire and damnation, I am not thinking about Percy. I put my arms all the way around her, jerking her toward me. Then, from behind us, the door latch snaps and someone says, "What's going on?" I whip my hands out of Jeanne's dress, nearly losing a finger in the process since somehow I've gotten tangled in the back lacings of her corsets. The Duke of Bourbon fills the doorway to the room, 2 more lordly-looking gentlemen at his sides, all of them with their mouths gaping, like beached fish. I let fly a choice 4-letter word and try to shield myself with the massive cage Jeanne has strapped to her waist. The Duke squints at me.
"God, Deasley?"
Yes, evening. Bourbon, wasn't it? His face sets.
"What the devil are you doing here?"
"To be clear," I say, edging toward the sofa where my clothes are piled, and cursing myself for having made such a dramatic show of flinging them away. I have to drag Jeanne with me to be certain I stay concealed. "Here, as in Versailles, because I was certainly invited."
"In my apartments? What are you doing in my damned apartments?"
"Oh, you mean here as in here?"
"You vile little rake. Just like your..."
His face is going red, and I brace myself, but his attention is commandeered by Jeanne, still standing bare-breasted at my side.
"Mademoiselle Lebray, cover yourself for God's sake," he snaps.
Jeanne starts tugging at her corset, which does less to cover her and more to emphasize the fact that she's not. The 2 other men are gaping at her chest, and Bourbon looks like he's about to commit homicide upon anyone within an arm's distance, and I am well-versed in seizing the moment, so I snatch my clothes off the sofa and make my escape straight out the open window. Which is how I come to be running through the gardens of the Palace of Versailles, dressed only as nature intended. I round a hedgerow flanking the orangery, realizing that beyond actually fleeing the scene, I have no exit strategy. I have a strong sense I'm being chased, and I haven't time to stop on the lawn and redress. I try to pull my breeches back on as I go and nearly lurch face first into the shrubbery. So I choose to keep my clothing bundled up in front of my most vulnerable parts and continue my flight. I skirt the wall of the palace, trying to avoid the windows and stay between the topiaries. There isn't an empty room, nowhere I could dart in and hide or re-robe myself. I'm disoriented and distracted and go farther than I intend to. When I round the next corner, I find I'm in a courtyard, partygoers spilling down the stairs and into the bright lights. I stop dead,
which is a fatal miscalculation on my part because a woman sees me and shrieks. And then everyone turns to stare at me. The Viscount of Disley, standing in the courtyard with his hair askew and a woman's powder smeared across his face like flour, and also without a stitch of clothing on. And then, because Fortune is a heartless bitch, I hear someone behind me say, "Monty?" And, of course, there is Percy.